This is KPFT Houston. You're listening to the Sunday Monitor with Pokey Anderson and Mark Babawi. Tonight's show will feature two live interviews. Actually, just been informed, 2.5 live interviews. The first, after the news, will be with 27-year CIA veteran Ray McGovern. Ray is turning into somewhat of a frequent guest on this show, but his expertise in the field of intelligence is very hard to rival. Tonight, we'll be talking to him about Iran and the continuing unraveling of the leak of the CIA identity of the wife of the former U.S. ambassador. To Joe Wilson. But primarily we're talking about Iran and the new national intelligence estimate that was leaked showing that Iran is at least 10 years away from nuclear weapons. Right after Ray, we'll have Joyce Riley on the show. Joyce is the spokesperson for the American Gulf War Veterans Association. She's also the narrator of a new DVD that I just watched. It's called Beyond Treason, the U.S. government's long history of conducting deadly military experiments. It looks at depleted uranium and places it in the context of previous U.S. experiments, including things like MK Ultra, the White Lab Project, and various other things that we'll be discussing in some detail. On the DVD also is Dr. Doug Rocky, who we've interviewed here previously about depleted uranium. It's a very interesting watch if you want to have a look at it. BeyondTreason.com is the website. Those are the two feature interviews we have. We're going to jump right into the news headlines, and the first one up is Pokey. We're going to try and keep these as brief as we can and get to Ray very soon.
Right, and the last of our headlines will go directly to Crawford, Texas for the protest that's going on there and talk with diplomat Ann Wright. Commemorations mark this week the 60th anniversary of the dropping of an atomic bomb by the United States on Hiroshima is being commemorated with solemn ceremonies as the number of survivors of that attack continues to diminish. For new developments and new perspectives on this 60-year-old story, you can listen to the Democracy Now! Archives from Friday. They've got some new documentation on the deed and its aftermath. Some of this was suppressed for decades. Also, you might listen to the KPFT archives for a special program that broadcast on Friday at 2 p.m. To find transcripts and sound archives for Democracy Now!, go to www.democracynow.org. And for sound archives for KPFT shows, including this one, you can go to www.kpftx.org. And another commemoration this week, the Voting Rights Act is being looked at. That was passed 40 years ago. Tens of thousands of people marched yesterday in Atlanta to urge that the act be fully reauthorized. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, Jesse Jackson, and Congressman John Lewis were among the speakers. Lewis said, "Our democracy depends on protecting the right of every American citizen to vote in every election." He participated in the Southern civil rights struggles of the 1960s that secured passage of the Voting Rights Act. Recounting a 1965 march in Alabama, Lewis said, quote, "We were beaten, tear-gassed, and trampled by horses." Lewis worked with three civil rights workers, Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman, who were murdered by the Klan in Mississippi in 1964. During those years, it was hard, almost impossible, for a person of color to get to vote. They had to interpret sections of the Constitution, sometimes in foreign language, and this was called a literacy test. The state of Mississippi had a black population of 450,000, but only about 16,000 blacks were registered to vote then. Conservatives are pushing to modify the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. One of the modifications they want would no longer require 9 states, mostly southern, to get federal approval before changing voting rules. Another regards foreign languages being available to those who don't speak English. Cynthia McKinney, in her speech yesterday, said, quote, "Today we are here to demand our due, life, liberty, and the right to vote. On machines that we know will accurately count our vote. And on this, we will not be hoodwinked, snookered, bought out, or bushwhacked. Up, you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. No more strange fruit." And then, just as another note about a voting rights activist, we have a sad news that Reverend Bill Moss, who was here in Houston at the election assessment hearing, has passed on. Apparently, he died of a stroke this week. And I got to meet him. He was a really fine fellow. He was the lead plaintiff in Moss v. Bush in the questions about the Ohio election, a very wonderful fellow.
That's always sad news to hear of losses like that. Of course, one of the big stories this weekend, yesterday, was the anniversary of the bomb being dropped on Hiroshima. Unfortunately, we're not going to have time to get into that. I've got about 25 web browsers open in front of me, and I'm trying to decide which headlines to give you. We just don't have enough time, unfortunately, to get into all of them. Some news from the UK. Tony Blair has outlined a raft of plans extending powers to deport or exclude foreigners who encourage terrorism. Now, of course, this doesn't take into account the fact that those accused of being involved in the London bombings were not foreigners. They were actually British citizens. And we'll see how that affects things in the UK. But one of the things that is also going on in the UK is that people are protesting. And there have been six people been arrested outside Parliament, about 100 campaigners staged a protest in Parliament Square against the Serious Organised Crime and Police Act. The only person in the UK who is allowed to protest outside Parliament is anti-war activist Brian Hoare. He's the only one in the country allowed there without authorisation because his four-year vigil predates the new law. So we'll see what happens with that. But other news from the UK, unfortunately, another death, and that is former foreign minister passed away today.
Robin Cook.
Yeah, he was apparently a very healthy person. He was an avid cyclist and a walker, and he was actually walking out in the hills of Scotland when he passed away. He was a former foreign minister. He became the leader of the party in the parliament before he resigned over the Iraq war, and he did just recently pass away, as we said. Related news to the bombings, it looks like three people have been arrested and charged over the July 21st attacks where the bombs didn't go off. And that's about it from the UK. And Pokey, how many more headlines do you have? You've got two more?
Right.
Well, why don't you give us one of those and I'll cherry pick, as Ray says, between what's left over. I've got about 20 to pick from.
This week, in a closely watched race, Republican Gene Schmidt defeated Iraq veteran and Marine Paul Hackett in southwestern Ohio for an open congressional seat. The Republican Schmidt's margin of less than 4,000 votes, 52% to 48%, was much tighter than had been expected. This is a district that the GOP has dominated for three decades. Registered Republicans outnumber Democrats by more than 3-1. Bush tallied more than 60%.
You want me to jump in?
Yeah, just for a minute.
All right. Well, we're both actually we both have colds and throat infections, so bear with us if you hear some spluttering tonight going on. The headlines I was going to give you actually are Iraq related. The U.S. military said on Thursday that four more American service members died in Iraq, including a Marine killed in the Euphrates River. It looks like 48 soldiers were killed in 12 days. Other Iraq news. It looks like that U.S. troops in Iraq had been demanding rent for Iraqi-owned businesses inside Baghdad's Green Zone to raise money for a, quote, soldiers' fund. The military officials and sources within the troops battalion said on Friday the disclosure is the latest to emerge in a wide-ranging investigation into the conduct of the 1st Battalion of the 184th Infantry Regiment of the Guard, which is headquartered in Modesto, California. Military officials confirmed previously that the battalion's commander, Lieutenant Colonel Patrick Frey, had been suspended, and that one of the battalion's companies based in Fullerton, California, had been removed from patrol duties and restricted to an army base south of Baghdad, the capital of Iraq. According to officials and members of the battalion, soldiers from the battalion's Bravo Company, based in Dublin, which is an East Bay suburb of San Francisco, approached several businesses earlier this year that were owned and operated by Iraqi nationals, and they basically were demanding rent to create what they called a soldiers' fund. Sounds a little bit like an extortion and racketeering issue. We'll see what happens to them. I just mentioned earlier the new crackdowns that Tony Blair is proposing in the UK, and he has insisted, as the British government has insisted, for officially at least, that the attacks in the UK have nothing to do with Iraq, they have nothing to do with UK foreign policy, that terrorism predates 9/11, etc., all these things. Broadcast Thursday from Al-Qaeda's Ayman Zawahiri blamed Tony Blair for the July 7th attacks. He said the policy of aggression against Muslims was the main motivation, and he also said, quote, by linking the bombings to Iraq, he basically sent the message that no matter what is said, London is a target and Blair is a liar. So we'll see what goes on with that. But it should be noted here that an internal study by the UK Ministry of Intelligence, MI6 and MI5, did state that Iraq was a galvanizing force in motivating people to carry out acts of terrorism within and against British targets. So the intelligence ministries in the UK definitely see a connection, even if the government maintains publicly that there isn't one.
All right, let me try again here. Looking at the congressional election again in southwestern Ohio, this was expected to be a slam dunk for the Republican. And Bob Fitrakis in Columbus, Ohio, is reporting that a computer glitch in Claremont County, which accounted for roughly a quarter of the votes, happened as the votes were being counted. Claremont gave Schmidt the margin. And it looks like around 9 o'clock, there was about a dead heat, and then all of a sudden, Schmidt kind of jumped away from the from her opponent, the Democrat, Mr. Hackett. Apparently, with about 80% of the vote in, the Republican lead was very slim, about 900 votes, and then as the last votes came in, that lead quadrupled. There was a, quote, technical malfunction in Claremont with optical scan readers. It was blamed on humidity, but once the counting resumed, the vote total changed dramatically. According to one study by a statistical person at Democratic Underground called Truth Is All, he said in the largest of the precincts in Claremont, Schmidt didn't lose any precincts at all, but in the small precincts, she lost 1 out of 5. So that's sort of an anomaly. You may recall that in the November election, George W. Bush got basically his entire Ohio margin in those counties, Claremont, Butler, and Warren, in southwestern Ohio, thus giving him Ohio, thus giving him the entire presidential election. There was a Homeland Security alert in Warren County then that then later, later the FBI said, well, we don't know anything about it. There were also stickers that were placed over votes that apparently carry votes in Claremont County. Officials again said, we don't know anything about it. So we'll check on that. Hackett criticized Bush strongly, and some people said, well, he shouldn't have been so outspoken. But he says, quote, meant it, said it, stand by it. He told this to the Cincinnati Post. I'd say it again. For every vote I may have lost because of it, I probably picked up one or two. The unfolding scandals involving the Ohio Republican Party there probably helped him as well. So we'll see. We'll be following that.
Well, in the interest of time, should we go to Ann Wright and then skip the final one and maybe push that out later if we have time? What do you think?
That's the final one.
Okay. Well, let's go straight to Ann Wright. You said she's in Crawford, Texas. Cindy Sheehan is the mother of a former Iraqi veteran. So why don't you tell us what's going on, and we'll hopefully hear from her as well.
Yeah, we got to meet Ann Wright when she spoke here at a standing room only speech about the Downing Street minutes. She served the United States for 35 years, including deputy ambassador to various far-flung places, including Mongolia, and resigned on the eve of the war in Iraq due to her disagreement with the policy. And she's standing there right now, I think. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Thank you, Pokey. Yes, I'm out here in some cow pasture. As close as we can get to Bush's summer vacation home, 5 weeks on vacation while hundreds, thousands of people are dying. I can he's still on the longest vacation in the history of presidential vacations.
Well, it's hard work, you know.
It really is. I want to say that your two other earlier comments about in the UK about the death of Robin Cook, that's so sad. He was one of the people, too, that resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq, and I remember reading his very eloquent letter of resignation. So it's with great and heavy heart that we see a fine, outstanding person who stood up for his for the ethical way to live life and hold your government accountable. And then also the comment about Brian Hobb being on Parliament Square and six people being arrested because they didn't have the permit. I was in London about 2 months ago and sat on a Sunday afternoon at Parliament Square with Brian Hobb and a group of people who were there to protest the British involvement. And what a remarkable array of materials they have there facing the UK Parliament.
Well, let's set the stage here. Yesterday, Cindy Sheehan, the mother of an Iraq soldier who lost his life there, went over there in with about 60 protesters and stood out in the heat. I believe it was 95 degrees the entire afternoon.
It was 130, I'll tell you.
Well,
it was Texas hot.
Right. In the shade, that would be 95. And she did have a conversation with two Bush aides, but she's demanding to speak with Bush. She says she's willing to go to jail if necessary. Hunger strikes are planned. Is that correct?
Well, if the president doesn't come forward to meet with the mother of a person, a soldier that was killed in Iraq, he meets with some that seem to agree with the policies of being there. He doesn't meet with any of the family members of those who are saying that the troops should come home, that indeed the troops should never have been sent to Iraq.
Well, he's saying it's a noble cause, and she wants to talk to him about what exactly did my son and all these other sons and daughters die for?
That's right. It's very unclear from the variety of statements that the president's made over the past 2 years exactly what was the reason for us going there. In fact, I resigned in opposition to the war in Iraq after 35 years, as you mentioned, because I felt that reasons that were being given were satisfactory. I mean, it in no way did it meet any of the three rationales or legal ways that, I mean, you talk about legal way to go to war, but there are such things, and the Bush administration met none of them.
Well, so you're going to be out there. There's how many people are out there right now?
Well, right now, let's see, there's 5, 10, 15, 20. There's about 22 people, and there have been people that have been coming in from parts of Texas that are just driving in. In fact, President Bush apparently sent us some chicken just a minute ago. We got a box of what's called Bush's chicken. I've never seen that before, but it came in a little cardboard box, actually brought by a fellow who has moved Texas from California, and then he said, I didn't know where I was going, didn't know what was going to happen, and my neighbors now are, he said, I'm glad you're my neighbors now, you the protesters are here.
Well, we can only hope that chicken isn't produced by the same company that made the Thanksgiving turkey that was served in Iraq.
That was a plastic one.
Hopefully it's edible.
The coverage for this protest has been unusual. Over 500 hits on Google this morning, including and then appearances for Cindy Sheehan on CNN, CBS, ABC, and so on.
Yeah.
Code Pink is helping to provide support for this protest, and they're asking for things like, obviously, more people, food, water, tarps, donations. And if you want to get in contact with anybody, we'll have that number here for you in just a few minutes at KPFT 713-526-5738. And we'll probably be talking to you again, Ann Wright, as you stick around there in Crawford, Texas.
Well, I'll tell you what. Everybody in Texas, if you haven't been to Crawford, you ought to come on out here and see this place.
Okay.
You ought to come out and be a part of history of where a woman is standing up, a woman who's lost her son in an illegal, immoral war, is out here and saying she will stay here until the President of the United States comes out and tells her why her son died. So it will do your heart good. I mean, I know there are a lot of frustrated people out there, a lot of people that are angry. Well, make a drive to Crawford. Come on out here and sit with us, chat with us, and I'll tell you, you'll feel a lot better. You'll still be in hell, but at least you've been with some people that you will be participating in an action that you'll remember the rest of your life.
Thank you very much. Ann Wright, former diplomat out there in Crawford, Texas, with Cindy Sheehan and other protesters.
Well, we are going to be running short of time, so I think we're going to jump straight in with Ray McGovern. Ray is a 27-year veteran of the CIA. His duties at the CIA included chairing national intelligence estimates and preparing the presidential daily brief. Those most authoritative genres of intelligence reporting have been the focus of the press many times, especially in the 9/11 commission hearings. During the 80s, Ray was one of the senior analysts conducting early morning briefings with the president, one-on-one with the vice president and secretary of state of defense, the chairman of the joint chiefs, and so on. Ray, welcome back to the Sunday Monitor.
Thank you, Mark. Good to be back with you.
It's nice to have you back. It hasn't been very long since we last had you on, but there's a lot of things going on that we need to discuss with you. First of all, Iran. The national intelligence estimates in your day, were they known to be accurate, and how accurate do we think this new one is that was leaked saying that Iran is 10 years away from nuclear weapons?
Well, we always strive for accuracy, but during my day, we didn't have to worry too much about political pressure. Political pressure that succeeded in corrupting the most recent estimates. And so that's why we were pleasantly surprised to hear that a new estimate on Iran shows that it probably won't have a nuclear weapon for another 10 years, if then. You may recall that Dick Cheney and others had been beating the drum saying that Iran was on the verge of getting nuclear weapons, and so we had to do something right quick. Well, I don't know how urgent it is if they do have a program for years.
Well, and recess appointment, UN Ambassador John Bolton went on the record saying it'll be too late, Iran will have nuclear weapons, almost echoing the mushroom cloud language that Condoleezza Rice was using about Iraq. What are the other parallels that we can look at here?
Well, the difference, the parallels are very stark. It's exactly what they said about Iraq, of course, and they have even repeated that Iran supports terrorism. So the two bad actions justifying preemptive war seem to obtain in both cases. This time, however, the intelligence analysts who have been watching what's been going on and who have been pretty much chagrined at not speaking out when they should have on Iraq, clearly they've decided that they would seek out a journalist who has a good reputation of telling it straight and a good reputation for courage. Not surprisingly, it's a woman, Daphna Lintzer, and they gone to her, and she put it on the front page there on Tuesday, and the big headline says Iran won't have a nuclear weapon for another 10 years. Now, what does that mean? That means that if Bolton and Cheney want to make war on Iran, they're going to have to contend with a lot of questions with respect to what the intelligence says.
No, it's been speculated quite a bit that, you know, the U.S. doesn't have the ground force capacity to invade Iran and that maybe there is a role in there for Israel. What is your take on all of that?
Well, Israel is ready to, quote, do the job, end quote. And our forces are on alert, or at least they are prepared to take action against Iranian facilities. We know that from what Scott Ritter told us several months ago. The question is, will the go button be pushed? Everyone who knows anything about the situation, the balance of power and the implications here, says that would be crazy. They'd never do that. It would be crazy. Iran is several times the size of Iraq. It's got several times the number of people in it. It's got a military that works. It could destroy our shipping in the Gulf. There are all kinds of reasons why this would be lunacy, besides the fact that we don't have enough troops to go into Iran. There are, of course, Air Force generals that say we can do everything from the air. But, well, that's what they say. So it would be crazy to do that. All I can say in this case is that you have folks running policy toward that part of the world who, when I was briefing the George Bush the Elder, were uniformly referred to in government as, quote, the crazies, end quote. These are the folks responsible for starting the war in Iraq, thinking we would be met with cut flowers and open arms, and I would not put it past them. The more so, since the president seems to be in growing trouble, the more so rather than less so, I wouldn't put it past them to start a bombing campaign against Iran on the flim grounds that they're developing nuclear weapons, even though they know the intelligence judgment says they couldn't have a nuclear weapon for another 10 years.
It's mind-boggling, really, to consider the consequences of this. I mean, the way things have played out in Iraq were predicted by many people, including several guests on this show, who said that basically what has happened now is the only way it could have happened. Of course, similar predictions are being made by Iran. Do you think those predictions are being listened to at all in the White House? And is it likely to dissuade anybody? I mean, I guess what I'm asking you is, before Iraq, several people in the media, even the mainstream, painted, Colin Powell, for example, as somebody who was trying to reason and trying to moderate and trying to reduce the extremism of some of the desires of people in the administration. Is there such a figure, if indeed that was an accurate description at the time, is there such a figure today with regard to Iran, or have we lost any kind of moderating forces in this administration?
Well, it's hard to... Colin Powell saluted so sharply to the commander-in-chief on just about everything the commander said that it's really hard to gauge how much of a loss he is. But it is, it does go without saying that the circle of advisors around the president is narrower still than ever. And if there's anything he needs to do, it's to broaden his circle of advisors and go beyond those who are hell-bent on making war against Iraq and other Middle Eastern countries, carving up the Middle East in a different way, and ensuring U.S. access to oil. None of this is going to work. It doesn't matter that we're the sole remaining superpower in the world. It is beyond our capacity to do what the neocons, so-called, have tried to do by attacking Iraq and perhaps now Iran, namely get special access to the oil or control over it, make the region even safer for the state of Israel, and to put ourselves in a strategic position with permanent military bases so that we can dominate whatever else happens in that region of the world. Those are our aims. And until we openly acknowledge that we have given up those three objectives, until that time comes, we'll be in there forever.
Well, speaking of neocons, you wrote part of a book that's coming out, 84 different contributors. When is it going to be out? It's called Neocon and Neocon Again is the second volume of this. You said earlier today it was going to be out in the next week or so?
Yes, it will be. It's two volumes. The first volume goes into a more philosophical discussion of just war and has many theologians and philosophers as well as journalists like me. The second one is a more pointed volume, which has a number of essays. Mine is called Sham Dunk, Cooking Intelligence for the President. And in 20 pages, I give a sort of tour d'horizon of what I've watched over the last 3 years, and it's a very sad tale, actually, to watch what has happened to intelligence.
Well, for those who have access to the web and want to get a preview of some of that, you can go to afterdowningstreet.org and do a search on Ray McGovern, and you'll find... I think, is it going to be the 19th chapter, maybe, or the 19th part of the book? Because it's titled 19, Sham Dunk.
Yeah, it is the 19th chapter. It's actually, thanks for pointing that out. The text is up there on afterdowningstreet.org.
Ray, could I ask, in view of the fact that guys like Tenet and certainly the people on the ground in the FBI took a lot of the heat for 9/11, not preventing it, in view of the fact that the... Tenet's with the CIA, that the CIA took a lot of heat for, messing things up and, why didn't Iraq go the way it was supposed to, even though, of course, we know that the Office of Special Plans was stovepiping information up. And given the fact that the military is stretched to its limits and is having terrible problems recruiting, are these three entities likely to be able to exert any pressure on the president and policy?
This will sound strange, Bogey, but the answer is no. Take the military. Rumsfeld has appointed a whole array of sycophants who are more interested in getting the next star than they are in looking down at what's happening to their troops. That's a harsh thing to say, but I've seen it before in Vietnam, and I'm watching it again. It needs to be said. Look at the CIA. Well, Porter Goss is running that, the arch politician. I must say that I was shocked and very, very nicely surprised that the estimate comes out in a more sensible way than the one done before Iraq. So let's give him the benefit of the doubt on that. But everything else in his history suggests that he's going to do the president's bidding when and if asked. And the other, the FBI, well, what I've learned about the FBI over the last couple of years is they are in complete disarray. They have no management or leadership, and the degree of ineptitude is mind-boggling. Not only on 9/11, but you look You look at their lab work. You look at any aspect of the computers upon which they wasted $170 million for a program that doesn't work. They have no management there. And I know from the FBI alumni and alumnae who are in veteran intelligence professionals for sanity that even though it looks more suspicious, most of the FBI's blunders are due pure and simple to ineptitude and promoting people who don't know the first thing about the craft of intelligence or the craft of police work.
Former FBI translator Sibel Edmonds is trying to carry forward her attempt to be able to speak out about some of the corruption that she found as a translator. Any more updates on that?
Yes. First, I'd point out that Sibel Edmonds and Anne Wright, with whom you were speaking just a while ago, they're both members of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and I'm very proud of that. Sibel has filed a suit in the Supreme Court for redress on the use of this privilege that the government invokes called national security privilege, which is to say that any time the government says, well, we can't discuss this on national security grounds, a court suit is automatically wiped off the ledger, so to speak. She's suing on that. I think she's going to win. Meanwhile, there is a very interesting article on Vanity Fair, this issue, in which Sibel talks to a British reporter about all the things that were on those tapes that she and her colleagues were translating, mostly Turkish tapes, which indicate that the Turks were very deep into corrupt politics, corrupt financial dealings, corrupt drug running, and that some of our top politicians were involved. The evidence points to Danny Hastert as being one of the beneficiaries of Turkish largesse, and even the favors that they extracted from him for their largesse are spelled out in that article.
Do you think there's any realistic prospect of this stuff being investigated to a high level and things actually being done based on the investigations or not?
Well, it won't happen unless the American people all of a sudden wake up and see that the degree of corruption has reached all-time highs. The Congress, as you know, is dominated by the President's party, Supreme Court, same way pretty much. And so this has to come from the grassroots. And do we have experience of success and that kind of thing? Yes, we do. Vietnam was one such experience. The people got so upset with what was going on that it was the people that forced the Congress's hand. Congress cut off the money for the war, and the war was over. I think there's a realistic prospect that the people will be fed up when they finally get word of the extent of the corruption. And that's going to take a lot of blogging. It's going to take a lot of internet and emails, because the captive mainstream press, so far at least, is not telling that story. But the tide seems to be turning a little bit. And when I see the Washington Post allowing that headline on Tuesday, which said Iran 10 years away from a nuclear weapon, well, the implications of that are very deep. And it was a very positive sign that even the Washington Post may be coming around to report some of the news.
Well, you mentioned blogging, and it's really an indictment of the mainstream press that blogs are so popular because people, I guess, feel like they don't trust the content and they have to look elsewhere for some information. In fact, it's gotten to the point now where the mainstream press reports on the blogs quite regularly. It's a real turn of events that I guess maybe 2 or 3 years ago would have been impossible to predict. What's your take on the availability of information, and I guess I'm going to lead from that into the latest developments in the Joe Wilson, Bob Novak, Karl Rove situation as well?
Sure. Well, I would say that if you take the Downing Street minutes, for example, which showed that the war was justified by cooked intelligence, those minutes, even though some of us wrote them up promptly on the blogs, and I did on TomPaine.com, it took the New York Times 5 weeks and the Post even longer to tell a story. It's a story about deliberate deceit by the U.S. and the U.K. to justify an unjustifiable war. Now, the point I'm trying to make is simply that it was the blogs. It was us. It was TomPaine.com, TruthOut.com, Counterpunch.com, all these email services and all these websites that were pushing the word around to the point where the mainstream press could no longer ignore it. And it even got asked of the president and the president's spokesman. Similarly, with Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame, the blogs and the websites played an indispensable role in getting the truth out there, and also putting things into perspective. And maybe while we're on this subject, I'll just say a quick word. It really doesn't matter a great deal who said what to whom when, you know. This "who shot John" treatment the press is guilty of just obfuscates and throws smoke over the real issues. The real issues are this. Joe Wilson spoke out and revealed a lie, okay? A lie based on a forgery, and the lie went to the heart of the reasoning used to deceive our elected representatives in the Congress into authorizing a war. That was the forgery. Now, who did the forgery?
Well, actually, it's even worth pointing out that before he spoke out, he let the administration know through reporting channels within the CIA what his opinion exactly was. And he only spoke out when that opinion was summarily dismissed and certain language was included in the State of the Union.
That's exactly
so
right.
So it's not like he came out pointing fingers immediately.
It took him months, and they basically challenged him to go to the press.
Yeah, I mean, he did his job. He reported it the way he saw it, and he was ignored, and then he felt compelled to reveal what his mission had been and what he had found, or as he wrote, what he had not found when he was sent to Africa.
That's exactly right. I'm glad you pointed that out. Sometimes we rush through these things in
right.
a shorthand kind of way. Yeah, they basically told him, as Pokey just said, okay, well, you go ahead and speak to the press, see how far you get. Well, he didn't get very far, but a courageous fellow named Patrick Fitzgerald has been named, and here we have a real pro in the mold of Archibald Cox, somebody who's tenacious, somebody who's a real pro, somebody who doesn't leak, just does his job. And what's really interesting now is Patrick Fitzgerald is the only independent act in this town. He hasn't told the White House what he's got, and they don't know, and they are sweating. They are sweating a lot. And if Patrick Fitzgerald does not get fired, and people need to realize that he works for the Attorney General, and Gonzalez can be told by Bush overnight to fire Fitzgerald, and he will.
And he was appointed by Bush or by Gonzalez or by Ashcroft before that?
By Ashcroft. And Ashcroft ducked out. And supposedly he was working for Ashcroft's deputy, Comey, but he's since left. The point is, he is not an independent counsel. He's a special prosecutor, and he has to report to the Justice Department. And so if he comes up with some really stern indictments, if he's got the goods on a lot of sensitive people, the odds are even in my book that he will be fired. Now, that would be like the Halloween night massacre back under Watergate there. What was that, 1973, I guess, where Nixon ordered Elliot Richardson, the Attorney General, to fire Archibald Cox. He refused and quit. So he asked his deputy, Ruckelshaus, who refused and quit. And Nixon had to reach deep down into the Justice Department. He found a fellow named Bork. And Bork said, oh, sure, I'd be happy to fire him. He fired Cox, and there was hell to pay, because then the whole country could see what was going on. If that happens now, that's the risk that Bush would run. But I rather think he would run that rather than to let Patrick Fitzgerald tell everything that he knows.
Well, there's a couple of flies in the ointment there, and I know a lot of us have been following this this Roe v. Plame situation for, a couple of years now. One is that, as you said, the fellow that oversees Fitzgerald has just left to take a job as counsel for Lockheed, and so we don't really know who's going to be overseeing him. And the other is that his term of appointment runs out in October.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we can see something happen fairly soon, and that's going to be pretty exciting. But what I would just go back for a second and emphasize is that there was a reason for the neuralgic reaction on the part of the White House, and that was that at this precise time when weapons of mass destruction were not being found, remember? The invasion had started. They looked all around and couldn't find any. So the major reason that they gave Congress, the cockamamie story that Iraq was looking for uranium in Niger, it was proved by Joe Wilson and others to be a cockamamie story, and that was a little bit too much. And what Karl Rove and the others in the White House were thinking is that, wow, if we let Joe Wilson get away with this, and Joe, you may remember, also let himself say to the press, this whole episode begs the question with respect to what else they're lying about. Okay, now that's throwing down the gauntlet. And Rove said, I'm sure he and Cheney, you know, we can't let this happen without retaliation, because there are hundreds of people in this government that know about the lies. And if they get the idea that they can, with impunity, release the lies to the press, we are in trouble deep. And that, and Joe is convinced of this as well, that is why they retaliated in whatever way they felt they could. They had no goods on Joe, so wives were fair game, as someone was famously told. So that was the reason they had to retaliate. And then there was another reason, and it's equally important, and that is this whole story was based on a forgery. Now, why was it that when Jay Rockefeller, the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intelligence Committee, asked Pat Roberts, the ranking Republican, the chair, shouldn't we have the FBI look into this forgery? This is very, very odd. Senator Roberts said, no, that would be inappropriate.
And this forgery, of course, was the documentation claiming that Iraq had been trying to obtain the uranium.
That's exactly right. Now, who did the forgery? I ask you, who did the forgery? Why is the United States government not interested in finding out who did the forgery? Do you know why? Because it was an inside job.
Well, it's certainly inappropriate to investigate, I guess, if it turns out to be an inside job. I guess we have to jump to our next interview, but I wanted to make a final comment and get your reaction to it. Given the reporting structure and the fact that Fitzgerald ultimately reports to Gonzalez, who, as we know from the last couple of weeks, was warned before the event that things were going to be investigated and failed for 12 hours to disclose to the White House that they shouldn't be shredding documents and removing things and so on. Given that reporting structure, what is your comment on the likelihood of success that Fitzgerald will have in this investigation? We'll have to close it with that thought.
Sure. Well, I like to see, Fitzgerald comes out of my boyhood. He grew up in New York City and educated by the Jesuits. I like to think that the fellow has the kind of integrity that even if he is boxed in at every step, he will exercise his prerogative to issue a report. No one can prevent him from issuing a report.
Let's hope you're right, and we'll certainly read the report when it comes, if it comes out, and we'll probably be getting your reaction to it, among others, and thank you for your time.
Most welcome.
Thanks
a lot. That was Ray McGovern. He's a 27-year CIA analyst, chaired the National Intelligence Estimates, prepared the Presidential Daily Brief. He's been a guest on our show several times. As I said before, if you want to look up some of his most recent work, go to afterdowningstreet.org. And put Ray McGovern into the search box there. Thanks, Ray, for joining us. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Joyce Riley. Stay tuned. Well, joining us now live is Joyce Riley. She is a registered nurse. She's also the spokesperson for the American Gulf War Veterans Association. Roy, welcome. I meant to say not Ray, because we just had him on. I meant to say Joyce Riley, of course. Joyce, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Forgive me, my medication is my cold medication is making my mind a little cloudy.
No problem.
And it doesn't seem to be helping my throat as much as I hoped, so hopefully things will improve as the show moves on. You also narrated a DVD that I just finished watching. It's called Beyond Treason, the U.S. Government's Long History of Conducting Deadly Military Experiments and the Documents That Prove It. It's a two-part DVD. The second is full of documents. It makes for some pretty frightening viewing, I have to tell you. I'm sure you're aware of that since you narrated it. Before we get into depleted uranium and Gulf War illness or syndrome, as some people have called it, paint some background for us with things like Project White Coat, Gulf War veterans may or may not have known anything about that, but Project White Coat and MK Ultra and various other things like that. What is the history of the U.S. government's experimentation, shall we say, on veterans and former veterans?
Well, we know that the U.S. government has been involved in the experimentation of our military, at least for the past 50 years. We were able to get a document, Senate Report 103-97, which is on that CD-ROM that you mentioned is the second part of Beyond Treason. And in the CD-ROM are thousands of pages of documents that we have been able to obtain to support exactly what we're saying in the documentary. What has happened is that after the Gulf War, when I became ill, after serving as a flight nurse aboard a C-130 aircraft in support of Operation Desert Storm, I became quite ill, and I found out a lot of other people were ill, and the Department of Defense was denying the whole thing. They still are, saying that there's a lot of mental problems, but that's about it. And that's kind of their treatment of the Gulf War I troops. But I began to do my research, and other people came forward and said, you think that's bad, you ought to see what they've done in the past. And this Senate Report 103-97, it's a Department of Veterans Affairs document that was never supposed to be released to the public. It was for committee members only. Well, one of the committee members leaked a copy of it, and we now have that copy. And in there, it states the following. During the past 50 years, hundreds of thousands of our military have been experimented upon without their consent, without their knowledge or consent. And in there it lists a number of the experiments, such as the one you mentioned, Operation White Coat, which is the use of several thousand Seventh-day Adventist young men who were offered up by their church to be guinea pigs in biological testing. They were chosen because they didn't drink Coke, they didn't drink coffee, they didn't drink alcohol. They were about as pure as you could get in a human being, and they offered them conscientious objector status for the fact that they became a guinea pig for the U.S. government. Then we talk about some of the other operations, such as MKUltra, which a lot of people are now familiar with. It's a real project. It was 166 sub-projects in the MKUltra mind control arena, of which many of them, of course, are alleged to be going on today, only under the direction of DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. So we have a history of 50 years of taking troops in, experimenting upon them, then casting them out, not even finding out if they were harmed by the experiment or killed, and we then move on to the next experiment, waiting for the next army to die. And that's what we're seeing there, unfortunately, is just waiting for an army to die, one after another.
And I guess that leads us to depleted uranium. Is your view that the use of DU, and then I guess as a parallel to that, the use of the various inoculations and shots and pills and various things that the troops were given, is it your view that those things were a deliberate experiment, or that this kind of happened by the seat of the pants, so to speak?
It's deliberate, intentional use, knowing full well the side effects and the damage that they would cause. The U.S. government in 1985 began selling biologicals to Iraq. They began selling chemicals to Iraq. First George Bush was involved in this through the Commercial Credit Corporation, a commercial commodity corporation. And they went through a bank called Banco Nacional de Lavoro in Atlanta, Georgia, in which they were able to ship over $5 billion worth of credits, commodity credits, to Iraq. Iraq didn't purchase food. They didn't purchase anything other than biologicals, chemicals, and the munitions to shoot them off. So thus we had Gulf War I and the resulting damage as a result of biologicals and chemicals that were sprayed on them, amongst a lot of other things.
And of course some of the things that were purchased by Iraq were the very same things that were being pointed to by Colin Powell in his UN presentation, you know, botulinum, anthrax, various other things, ricin and so on.
That's right. And I was in Houston at the time that we discovered this, and working with Dr. Garth Nicholson at MD Anderson Cancer Center. And it was interesting because what we found then was that we had batch number, we had dates they were shipped, where they were shipped to, and found that the U.S. government had a huge program of selling biologicals through a company called American Type Culture Collection, ATCC. You can go to their website at atcc.org. We have evidence now they've been selling biologicals to the U.S. government for many years. In this case, they became lethal. Now, I talked with Dr. Kilpatrick from the Pentagon and debated him on a Pacifica radio station, and it was interesting. I was surprised, first of all, that he came on the air, and he tried to talk me down and say, oh, now, Ms. Rada, you know that nurses, you've seen them use these kinds of things in research. And I responded to him and said, no, sir, you don't use it in 55-gallon drums in research, number one. Number two, it's attenuated or weakened. And number three, it's going to be, it will not be capable of reproduction if you're going to use it for research.
Presumably in each research case you actually follow up and you see what happened to the subject.
Exactly. And there's some kind of research going on at the time, not putting it into Scud missiles. And thus, we had it put into Scud missiles, which were lobbed against our troops, many of them that landed without exploding. When a Patriot did not hit them, a Patriot missile did not hit them, and they landed on the ground, they had liquid leaking out of them. In a conventional missile, you don't have liquid leaking out of it. In that area where those Scud missiles were found, the camels were dead, the flies on the camels were dead, and it was just an obvious biological chemical exposure area. But then we had depleted uranium in Gulf War I, which nobody knew anything about. And this is not a bash on George Bush, because I voted for George Bush when he was governor in Texas, when I had not come to my senses yet. I was still seeing him as being a good leader. And this was, believe it or not, after his father did his thing, I still voted for George Bush Jr. Well, lo and behold, we didn't know that George Bush Sr. had greased the skids and basically approved all of this to be done. And there's a book called Spider's Web that was written by the Financial Times of London editor and taken off the market 2 weeks after it came out. You can still get some copies of it. It's pretty incredible, and it details George Bush's involvement in this. But then we had
Bush Sr. or Jr.?
Bush Sr.'s involvement. And then we had this advent of depleted uranium, and I will stick with that, because this is a huge, massive killing machine. The Middle East is devastated for eternity now. It's going to be inhabitable. The United States used depleted uranium, as you're probably aware of, in Yugoslavia, Bosnia, under Clinton, so it was not a Republican issue. It was used in Republican and Democrat administrations. It was used in Afghanistan. It's been used in Iraq. We now have 350 tons that has been dropped in Gulf War II. Depleted uranium is a very dense metal. It's very soft. Once it is shot out of the barrel of the gun, it catches on fire immediately. It's pyrophoric, and it hits its target, whether it would be a bunker, whether it's going to be a home, concrete, or a tank, whatever it is, it will bore through it like butter. I mean, it goes straight into it. The problem, though, is that as it is pyrophoric, it sprays off these little particles that are about 0.2 microns, and they are about the size of a bacteria, so you breathe them in, or you ingest them in the food that has been contaminated, in the water that's been contaminated, and you become radioactive, basically, for the rest of your lives, or affected by radiation the rest of your life.
And you pass on, sorry to interrupt you, and then, of course, if you're a male, for example, you pass on this radioactivity to your children, when you give birth, and, you know, birth deformities and so on are sharply increased in Iraq.
Exactly. Not only is the troop going to be sick, he is going to radiate his wife through sex, and the child will be involved, as you said. Now, we're not talking about just 120,000 troops or 140,000 troops that are going to come back and pass this on. We have rotated in and out of Iraq. Most people are not aware of this, almost 1 million people. So we've got 1 million troops coming back to affect 1 million partners and affect children, and we're talking about a huge problem.
Well, let's look at some of the numbers, because some of them, as I said, I was watching this DVD and you know, I thought I knew a lot about the subject. I've actually interviewed Doug Rockey before on this show, but a couple of the numbers that came out were pretty frightening. You said 1 million troops have been rotated in and out of Iraq. During Gulf War I, so-called, it was something like 600,000 or 700,000 people. Is that right?
Correct.
And out of those, as things stand right now, about 10,000 to 15,000 are dead, and something like 200 to 250,000 are on disability benefits from the VA.
That's correct. It's even more interesting when you consider that there's been 250,000 that are permanently disabled. That is their term, permanently disabled by the Department of Defense. Now remember, 100-hour war, 148 were killed, and half of those were by friendly fire. So we had 70 people really legitimately killed in a wartime situation by the, quote, enemy. And yet, since that time, we've had a 60,000 increase. And now we've got 225,000, 250,000 troops that are now permanently disabled, and another 200,000 that were turned down for disability because they didn't fill out their paperwork correctly. So we're talking about, really, 500,000 out of the 700,000. We're talking about three-quarters of our people that are now sick that serve their country. And that's why you're not seeing much from Gulf War I troops now, is because they're ill and they're compromised.
It's pretty frightening. I mean, what's the ratio, do you think, of people who are serving in Gulf War I who also served in Gulf War II? What sort of numbers are we looking at?
Well, according to the senator from Minnesota that died in the airplane crash.
Wellstone. Paul Wellstone?
Yeah, thank you. Senator Wellstone had committed to us that in 1995, now remember that's, 4 years after Gulf War I ended. In 1995, 90% of the military that served in Gulf War I was out of the military. They had been moved out for whatever reason. Ill, they knew they were going to get ill, fast track to retirement, whatever. But we only have 10% of our military left that served in Gulf War I.
Hmm.
That is huge. People don't know that. That's why we are, that's why when you see these lieutenant colonels on TV right now, they look like they're still wet behind their ears. I mean, I see a lieutenant colonel on TV and they look like they should be a captain. They've been promoting below the zone to get them up to rank because they didn't have any higher level positions because so many of them got out after the first Gulf War. So these are the kinds of things that are being withheld from the American public. And myself, I served at Kelly Air Force Base there in San Antonio when it was open. And I was working at St. Luke's Episcopal Hospital as a heart transplant nurse at the time. And going back and forth every weekend and catching flights. And we came back sick. Got no response from the local VA there in Houston. We weren't even allowed to go there because we were reservists. And when we were sick, we went to the Department of Defense, and they said, no problem, nobody's sick, everybody's fine, just go about your business. Well, we were too sick, and I had to quit the reserves. And I was, in fact, I was hospitalized there in Houston in December of 91.
Joyce, I'm just going to have to interrupt you because we've got about a minute left, so we're coming up pretty hard against the deadline here. Just want to throw those numbers out one more time because, for me, I think they are perhaps the most striking thing. 15,000 troops who served in Gulf War I are dead. Almost 500,000 are ill and slowly dying from what the Department of Defense calls a mystery disease. What are your final comments before we go, and if you could give the website out as well?
Okay, it's beyondtreason.com, beyondtreason.com. Let me tell everybody how to get a free documentary. If you are a military person and you have a DD-214, you can fax it to us. Just go to the website, beyondtreason.com. It will tell you how to do that. And then we will send it to you at no charge. And if anybody wants to get it, they can call us at 877-GULF-VET, 877-GULF-VET. But we're going to give them away free to the troops, especially those that were involved in experiments. But the bottom line is we have got to stop the use of depleted uranium. We have got to test these people immediately and find a way to reverse this and chelate this out of the body, because the heavy metals are going to kill these troops.
Okay. Well,
there are those that say that this would qualify as a war crime.
Oh, it's a nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it absolutely is a war crime, and Japan has already found them guilty.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but we may have to revisit with you to get some more of these details out. BeyondTreason.com, the video DVD is called Beyond Treason, the U.S. Government's Long History of Conducting Deadly Military Experiments. It's narrated by Joyce Riley. Joyce, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Joyce.
Joyce is the spokesperson also for the American Gulf War Veterans Association, and as you heard, she served herself in the reserves. That's all the time we have, I'm afraid, for tonight. I want to thank Pokey Anderson and Byron Jackson for their assistance. This is Mark Mowry saying thanks for tuning in, and join us again next week at 6. Good night.